So welcome everybody to a Praxis IO conference training on safety and accountability audits for grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. My name is Casey McGee and I'll be your host for today's call. And today we'll hear from Ellen Pence, who will talk about the working definitions of key terms in your audit project. So three quick housekeeping details. I'm going to leave all the lines open during the presentation unless we get a lot of background noise. If you can mute your line if you have a lot of background noise or you're calling from a speakerphone by pressing star 6, and then to unmute yourself, you press star 6 again. When you're speaking, please remember to say your name and the state you're calling from so we can recognize you. And as a reminder, we do record these calls. We make them available for $8 a CD, and the order form will go up on our website by the end of the series. Okay, Ellen? Welcome.
Okay, there's not too many of us on the line, so I think it would be good if we went around, did introductions, and had people say a little bit about if you're doing an audit, if you're thinking of doing an audit, if you did one and you want to do another one, wherever you're at with this whole thing. And let's start with you, Pat.
Well, I'm from New Orleans, and we have just put up a Family Justice Center. And that was not because we applied for that. It was at the request and the generosity of OVW and the Department of Justice. They just kind of felt sorry for New Orleans, I think, and wanted to do something for us. So we have put one up very quickly, and it has raised some questions that we have in New Orleans about a pretty dysfunctional criminal justice system. And so we are looking to try and do a safety audit, not just because of the Family Justice Center, but because we would like to try and get a handle on what we think is our intake system, which is our municipal court and our New Orleans Police Department. So that's all I'll say.
Is municipal court the same as like misdemeanor court?
No, misdemeanors can be handled in our state court as well as our municipal court. But municipal court is where the bulk or the majority of our domestic violence incidents get charged, because it's so much easier for our police department to charge them in municipal court.
Oh, I see. And then if you charge a municipal court, do you only have the opportunity to fine people, not to jail them?
No, they can be jailed, but not for very long, and it's much less, and it's much easier for the police department to do municipal court charges rather than state court charges, although the misdemeanors can be heard in both.
Oh, okay. Okay, great.
This is Nathaniel Weaver in New Orleans.
Hi.
Just to add to what Pat said, it is true, the vast majority of our cases do go to the municipal court. We have redundant laws, so we have a municipal domestic violence ordinance, and there's also a state law dealing with domestic violence. If they're charged with the state law, then they would go to our criminal state court. Typically, in the police department, I think there was a perception that cases in state court would wind up getting dropped by the DA's office and not handled appropriately. And the municipal court doesn't screen cases out. They try to prosecute all the cases, and so they felt like there was something that was being done. But she's right; it's not. It's meant to be for, I guess, lesser misdemeanors.
Okay. So for where I'm from, that would be like the same as an ordinance violation, going
right.
That route rather than, okay. And do you have a right to a jury trial then?
You do in state court, but you do not in municipal court.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, okay. Okay, good, thanks. Okay, who else is on? That's New Orleans. Seattle.
Hi, this is Amy Hayden, and I have with me Sharon Chu from the City of Seattle's Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Prevention Division. And pretty much our division is entirely new staff. Historically, this division has done a safety audit. We did one in 2003, which informed the creation of a strategic plan for the city. And now we're kind of in the process of figuring out do we need to be doing another audit, or kind of just learning what processes are out there that could help us with the work that we're doing with our current strategic plan as well as future planning efforts.
Okay. And do you have a particular thing that you're trying to do with your strategic plan, like some big initiative? Or?
There's a variety of objectives in the...
You went out, Amy.
Oh, sorry. The strategic plan covers about 8 different program areas.
Okay.
And so there's a variety of objectives under each that we're implementing, but we're thinking beyond this current plan, which ends in 2009, where do we want to be going in the future.
Okay.
Also on the line is Judy from Michigan. I'll just call on people.
Judy?
Judy, you still with us?
I guess you bored her to death, Pat, and she got off. As soon as you started going, as soon as you said New Orleans, fixing up New Orleans, she said, uh-huh.
Oh,
God.
Rat.
Okay, who else can see?
Debbie from Texas. Debbie, you still with us?
Hi, this is Debbie. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. We are doing an internal audit. We're not doing anything as elaborate as all of the external and anything to do with law enforcement. We're doing an internal with our own agency.
And what does your agency do?
We're victim services. We're a crisis center.
Mm-hmm.
And we have shelter. We have outreach services, counseling. We do a lot. We all house our main center, and all of our files and staff, housed right out of this one facility.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where we want to see if we're providing, the most safety that we can. We do have a BIP, Battles and Invention Program also,
mm-hmm.
And that's basically what we're looking at to make sure that we're doing exactly what we ought to be doing. If everything is effective as it can be. This is all real new for us, and we've been listening in on lots of teleconferences, and we've gotten lots of good tips. So
okay.
I think that we have a basis for a really good start. We're going to do our actual planning in about 2 weeks. The team that I have will do an actual planning stage, and we're very fortunate. We have some interns from Austin, and they're going to be assisting us in doing different projects with this. So we're very fortunate.
Okay, very good. Excellent. And remember that part of the assistance that the Praxis offers is we do sometimes beam in, to your audit team if you ever want, if you've got access to video conferencing room or something, which, there's a lot of those around, then we can actually meet with your whole team with you sometime, and you can talk to Casey about that if you need it.
Okay. I have part of the team in here today, so
okay.
they've been listening into different the workshops here as it goes around their schedules. So,
okay, great.
Thanks.
Who else is on?
This is Julie Christensen and Ron Gibbons in Grand Forks, North Dakota.
Uh-huh.
We did a huge audit with 11 different agencies between 1998 and 2001.
Uh-huh.
And right now, we just want to look at how the Abuse and Rape Crisis Program, the Supervised Visitation Program, and the court is working together to enhance safety for the victims and their children.
So the visitation, court, and the advocacy program?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And who else? Is that it, Casey, you think?
Yeah, that may be it.
Okay. Okay, good. Well, this is helpful to me. This is Ellen Pence. I'm from Praxis, and it's helpful to me to know who's on and a little bit of what you're doing so I don't overly generalize and not be a little bit helpful to you individually. I think I want to spend just a couple minutes going back and saying, what an audit is every time, if we just kind of remind people of this process, because you know, for a lot of us, this is a new thing to do, and when that we, one minute we think we get what it is, and the next minute we don't. But it's the reason it's called an audit is because it acts very much like when you have an, you know, you have a CPA come into your office, and you've been keeping books, and you know, they come in and they look to see what kind of internal procedures and what procedures you put into place that make sure that you know where your money is and you can account for it. Not just because somebody might abscond with it, but because you want to make sure that you're, you know, you're accounting for your money properly, the different funding bases, et cetera. So an auditor comes in and they follow little trails, and they follow these little money trails to see if everything is properly accounted for. So if you think about that in a system, a big system like the legal system or the child protection system or the combination of the courts and a visitation center and an advocacy program, that's a big kind of system that individual people are kind of beamed up into. You know, this woman gets beat up and her husband has been beating her up and they've got these three kids. And different members of that family get beamed up into these institutional processes. And an audit is a way of taking a piece of that institutional process and looking at it and answering a question about it. And usually the question people want to ask is, have we designed this institutional process in a way that promotes safety? Or have we designed this in a way that promotes accountability for offenders? And that's usually the basic question of a lot of audits. But other audits might look at, you know, are we really helping Hmong people in our community? Have we designed this in a way that really works for people with mental illness problems? Have we designed this in a way that works for non-English speaking people? So sometimes an audit will take a special population of people and look to see how it's doing. Sometimes the, you know, safety and accountability are usually at the underlying kind of notion of, are we keeping people safe? Are we holding offenders accountable? But the other part of that is oftentimes are there certain groups that we're doing better on than others, and which groups are kind of marginalized in our system and we're not providing so much safety for, and how could we? Other times people will look at more specific questions, like Casey and I worked in an audit in Iowa where the question was, when we intervene, you know, if I think we might all accept that when you batter, someone, you know, and most oftenly that's a man battering his partner, his woman partner, if she has children with him or with some from another relationship, the relationship between that woman as a mother and her children is almost always undermined in the battering relationship, and it's in many ways it's harmed. The relationship between children and their mothers are harmed by battering. And so in Iowa, they asked the question, when we intervene, do we make that worse or better? We probably don't make it neutral. We probably don't have a non-impact on the mother-child relationship. So what is our impact on the mother-child relationship as we intervene, with an eye towards how can we strengthen that relationship and not weaken it? So you can see that different people would ask different questions in their audit and look at different things. But an auditor always picks a certain piece of the system, like 911 and police and prosecution, say, let's just stick with those three and ask the question about those three. Some people say, let's look at the whole system from 911 all the way through. Some people just look at order for protection court. Some people, the very first audit I worked on, we just looked at sentencing. And we asked the question, have we built safety into the way we sentence on misdemeanor domestic assaults in Duluth? So that was the first audit really that was ever done, and it was a very narrow kind of focus. So when you're picking what you're going to look at, like for example in New Orleans where they're just starting this a whole justice center, they're going to bring different agencies together under one roof to work on cases together. And they have to think about, okay, if we want to use the safety audit process to look at what we're doing, who's the what? Is it all the agencies looking at themselves? Is it us collectively looking at each other? Are we going to look at how victims coming into this thing move from agency to agency? How do we want to use this process to make sure that we're working well together, but also that we're producing safety together? So if you think about safety as something that you're actively trying to make happen, in other words, people are out there beating up people, and these people, you know, they either call 911 for help or the neighbors call 911 for help, and the question is, when someone picks up that phone and says, 911, what's the nature of your emergency? That's the moment at which this family, this woman or this child or whoever's calling in, they get brought into the system as a case, and their individual circumstances now become something that an institution is going to handle as a case. And the goal with most of us working in the human service field, in the legal field or whatever, is to try to be relevant to what happens in real people's lives. You always know when you're working on something and you're doing something that's totally irrelevant to what people are experiencing. One of the reasons I thought there's not very many people on this call and I'd just like to know what you're all doing is that I have been on these calls before and yacked away about this and that and then found out later that 75% of the people on the call weren't even anywhere near where I thought they were at and wanting to do an audit. And so I'm just yapping away, writing down to OVW that I did a training for 56 people or whatever, and fulfilled my institutional duty, but there was a mismatch between what I did and what people needed. And many of us that work in institutions, we see that happening all the time. We're set up to do one thing, and then we look around us and think, oh, my God, how did we miss the boat this bad? Or else we don't notice that we missed the boat. That's a sadder situation, really, that we're missing the boat every day and we're just keep plugging away, doing what we plan to do and what maybe worked 10 years ago and doesn't now, whatever. So an audit is really a way of you stopping, stepping back, and watching that point at which people get drawn into your institutions and asking the questions, did they get drawn in the way that we really helped people? Did we keep this woman from getting beat up again? Did we help this guy figure out how not to beat up again? Did we stop him when he didn't want to do that? Did we put consequences in his way that really worked? Did we do something with those children so they didn't get used in really wicked ways as part of a battering situation? And specifically, how are we designed to do these things? So basically, this is a period of time, and it's nice, you know, if we have the resources to do this, where we can get a little bit of money from OVW to just step back and watch the cases come into our system and ask a bunch of questions about them. And that's basically what you're doing in an audit. You're picking a place that you want to look at and a question that you want to ask about what's the connection or the disconnect between what people need and what we're doing. So given that that's what you're trying to do, the very first disconnect for a lot of people is in this whole word safety. And so today we wanted to kind of take up the question of when we're talking about safety and we're talking about accountability, we're talking about domestic violence, some of the terms that we're using in audit, are we on the same wavelength about what we even mean? And when I say safety, and when a prosecutor says safety, and when a battered woman says safety, the three of us have the same thing in mind. And what's really quite important is, what does this battered woman have in mind? What is safety to her? And how is safety for her actually getting promoted or actually produced by how the system is set up to intervene in her case? So I'm just going to stop there for a little bit. And before we go on to define safety, accountability, and those words, are there any questions that just people have on the very general scope of the audit that has happened so far in these first couple calls and you kind of think, I still don't get what the hell this thing is, or anything you want to ask about that, because now is the time to do that. We'll just start with you, Pat. And I won't call on anyone, but if I get you talking first, then someone else will. Well, no, actually more people get off the phone, apparently, but go ahead.
You're a creep. Anyway, it seems to me that you're talking about an audit not just as an overview of what is happening now, but a redesigning of a system with a particular goal in mind. Is that what you would say?
Yeah. You know, Ryan, and I always think of it as that you're not auditing people, like, did this person do a good job or this or that? You're really auditing the administrators. Did they set up the work right? did they write the right job description? Did they write the right policies? Do they have the right resources allocated to people? Because you're watching them, you know, in audits you observe how cases work in the system, and then you interview all the players to see what's going on, and then you read files. That's basically it. You read files, you watch people, you talk to people. And when you're doing that, you're trying to figure out, when this case went from here to here to here to here, did the administration set up those processes in a way that really promoted safety? So you're not auditing individuals, does this cop get it or doesn't he get it or things like that. You're saying, did this police department, in conjunction with the prosecutor's office, set up this patrol intervention in the best way? Do they have the right policies? Do they have the right formats for writing reports? Do they have good supervision? Do they have good training? Do they give this cop the resources he or she needs? You're really looking at those kind of structural issues, not is this a good cop or a bad cop?
Well, Ellen, can you really do this kind of process unless you have the absolute cooperation and welcoming of the agencies involved?
Well, you know, you can do, if you have the welcoming of an agency, like the first audit I did was of the Duluth Probation Department, and they said, yeah, come on in, we'll meet with you, we'll talk to you, you can interview, you can watch us, you can read our files. I mean, they just said, yeah, let's try to make this thing the best we can make it. And they wanted it. They wanted to make the way that they did their pre-sentence investigations and the way they make recommendations, they wanted it to be really good. And partly that was because, you know, Duluth was a city that people were coming to look at, and they didn't want to have people come and look at them and not really look classy. So they said, yeah, okay, let's look and see if we can do the best job possible. Well, that's like a dream come true if you get that kind of cooperation. Other people will sort of say, well, all right, yeah, we'll go along with it because so-and-so and so-and-so is, and they don't really want you to look at it. But as they get involved in the process, they start to find themselves pulled into, oh, that's interesting, and most systems people want their systems to work decently. What they don't want is bad press, finger-pointing, that kind of stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you obviously, everyone has unique situations. You have a situation there that's incredibly unique. I mean, you have a long tradition of kind of the, you know, the good old boys network there that you're dealing with. But then you have the huge tragedy of Katrina and the meltdown, in many ways, of huge structures. So you have both an opportunity but an incredible obstacle to overcome there. So you know, what you're facing will be quite different than other people, but in some ways, everywhere you go, there's local conditions that make it different than other places. And but you're right that the best audit to do is one where someone's saying, come on in, look at what I'm doing. So, you know, when you're doing an internal audit, there's obviously some motivation to find things there. But even, you know, Judy, where you're doing your internal audit, you'll find people very, very defensive. Because you're going to look at things that you've been doing for 10 years and saying, is this really the right way to do this? And how come we're doing this? I did an audit in Western Australia a while back. And the organization that pushed for the audit was the shelter. And part of the shelter then became a part of the audit process. And we went to the shelter one night and interviewed all the residents from the shelter came to the meeting and wanted to be interviewed about things. And this one woman just said, she said, you know, I came in here 10 days ago, and she said, I had two options. One was to kill myself, and I didn't do that because I had children. And the other was to come into this place, which I had heard so many things about from him. I just thought I was going to walk into hell, and I didn't know what I was walking into, and I got here. And I desperately needed someone to talk to, and I got a little piece of paper that told me I had an appointment in 2 weeks with this woman. Now it's 4 days, and I'll get my appointment. But so far, I've been here, and people have been really nice to me, and they've fed me, they've fed my children, but no one's talked to me. And then other women around the table started saying the same thing. The shelter director is sitting off in the corner, not able to talk, because it's a focus group, and she can observe it, but not talk in it. and she's mortified as she's hearing the women talking, and they're saying that they need someone to talk to. And I'm leading this focus group, and I said, well, what about each other? Are you talking to each other? Well, yes, but usually when we all get together at a meeting, there's a staff person there, and then they lead it. And I said, well, describe to me a typical meeting. And, of course, the staff person really, in funny ways, kept them from talking with each other rather than encouraging it. Well, by the time this focus group was over, you could have scraped that shelter director off the floor. And it was right in front of, like, there was someone from the prosecutor's office there and the police. And when we all went out afterwards, the cop said, I was so glad that was you, people talking about you and not us. I said, don't worry, we're doing a focus group on cops tomorrow. But it was still really hard for, it's hard for people to hear that what they do with their time and how they're organized to do it needs a big shift or even a paradigm shift. And but for her, by the time that was over, she was sufficiently humbled to say, okay, I'm going to fix this. And, of course, she wanted to run in and fix it the next week. And I said, no, you can't do anything until we're done with the audit so that people start fixing things together in unison. You don't go off and say, oh, my God, that's terrible, we have to fix it. But you say, okay, that's not good, that's not good, that's not good, but then you planfully fix it. So, and that's why today when we talk, you know, this whole notion of defining what you mean by accountability and safety, you don't want to go off half-cocked and just fix things so you get more prosecutions. You know, we're not getting enough prosecutions. Well, more prosecutions doesn't necessarily mean more safety. So really being thoughtful and planful is a good thing. But back to what you said in the beginning, Pat, sometimes organizations that are a little bit resistant to do this, as they get into it, they start to really get into it and like it. And then other times they just are resistant from the beginning, they stay resistant. And then other times the way the audit is done can turn people who are open more negative because the audit gets done in kind of a negative way. So
that's what I'm looking for, is a way, and I sure am sure that Nathaniel is too. We're looking for a way to be positive and to strengthen the system that we have in place, but to try and be positive so that people will be more welcoming.
Right, and one of the nice things about the audit is that you're looking for how cases are put together from, you know, like 911, you're looking at the computer screens they have. Are they asking the right questions? If you listen to 25 or 50 911 tapes, and you've got a little checklist next to you saying, if I had to answer the question, did this person talk to the caller in a way that would make this caller want to use the system again? I'd have to say no, no, no. And then if I see that 30% of the time callers are treating people poorly, then I need to figure out why that is.
Uh-huh.
Instead of just saying, the dispatchers treat people like junk, you know. That's not an audit finding. That's an observation, that they're treating them poorly. Well, what's behind that? They didn't go into dispatching with the idea of treating people poorly.
Mm-hmm.
So it has something to do with their frustrations. It has to do with being, you know, maybe too many calls coming in. Maybe the idea that, you know, sometimes it's certain people that are calling in. Certain groups of people that there's a lot of hostility against. It might be that they have the whole 911 center might have some pretty negative attitudes about a group of people living on the reservation or something. They get treated different. You're trying to find if that's going on and then sit down as a team together and saying, we're not going to write something up that says, they treat people calling in from the reservation like junk. We're going to try to say, we're going to try to figure out what is that about, and then figure out a combination of training, like formats for how they ask questions, ways that they document things, and supervision that will offset that, so that a year from now, when you listen to those calls coming in from the reservation, you don't hear that same thing.
Uh-huh.
And always think about that a year from now. This won't be what we see or hear because we've restructured things.
I I think Pat does have a point. You know, in this particular case with the New Orleans Police Department and the DA's office, is just that the criminal justice system down here is constantly under attack, and a lot of times rightfully so. But there's an incredible amount of bad or negative coverage and negative reports that are coming out. So I guess just the challenge of finding a way to convince them that it's going to be constructive and not a negative report in the end.
Right, because one thing, you can say, look, this is a piece. It's like one crime. It's a piece of a crime that we could actually get a handle on, do things better, good press on, not negative.
Right.
I mean, you could almost start out with that, saying, we get so much negative press, all these things about people getting killed and all this and all that and the corruption and all that negative stuff. Why don't we take this opportunity to say, like, from the minute this case comes in, we're going to do these 10 or 15 things that aren't that expensive, don't require huge changes, yet if we can locate exactly where we want people to kind of organize their efforts, we could actually produce something for the media and everyone else that says, look, here's something we're really doing right.
Right.
That's a way of selling it to them, I think.
Right.
We have to be a not Kville.
Yeah, right. Okay. Anyone else who has something? So everyone kind of has an idea of what this audit thing is. It's you're taking a piece of the system, you're a combination of interviews, observations, and reading case files. You're looking to see how the cases are going through and why safety gets compromised when it does. And then if you can see places where the system is well organized to reinforce safety, what's going on there? Why right here is it so strong? What's going on? And usually you're trying to stay away from individual things. This judge is really good, he's really bad. Sometimes you can't help but notice that, especially in smaller communities, on some reservations where you have one or two people with a tremendous amount of power, then their personal attitude can have a huge difference. But basically in audits, you're really looking away from the individual into the structure of how their work goes. So let's talk a little bit about this notion of safety and the notion of accountability. And I think I'll start out with accountability. I always start out with safety. I'm going to do accountability first today. We always use this language of holding offenders accountable. But when I look at some of these lethality reviews and, looking at when people got killed, what went wrong? Well, obviously it went wrong that offender was not accountable to that victim's safety because he ended up killing her. And he wasn't held accountable maybe early enough or whatever. But usually you can see in those cases where if the system had been organized differently, there is a good chance that this homicide might not have happened. And so, an audit is almost like a pre-fatality review. Instead of waiting till someone's dead and going back and saying what could have been done different, you're going in there and looking at safety and where it drops out in cases and where it seems to be compromised. And you're looking at accountability. And so I wanted to just use this term accountability and say a few things about it, because usually when people think about accountability, they're thinking about the batterer being accountable to the woman. And that's what we want to do. Ultimately, we want to hold this batterer, this person who's using this violence, accountable for the harm that they've done to victims and accountable to any future harm that they might be doing. So in other words, we're trying to... there's a little saying that everybody says that you're trying to eliminate his opportunities to batter while reducing his inclination to batter. So the guy has the opportunity to hit her because he thinks, okay, this is my wife and da 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 da, and so he's got lots of opportunities to hit her. When we step in, when the community steps in, we want to start cutting him off at the pass and saying, nope, you don't get to do this, and reducing his opportunities, sometimes through protection orders, through shelters, through charges against him, that if he hits her again, he's going to end up in jail for a long time. A bunch of things that really cuts back on his opportunity to use this violence, intimidation, coercion freely. Now, you can do that. You can put
obstacles in the way of a batterer, and you can put the fear of the Lord in them that if you keep doing this, something bad will happen to you. But if you really want change to happen over a long term, you have to really change their hearts, to their inclination, their desire, their notion of entitlements to do it. Because if you're just constraining them to consequences, eventually something will happen and that won't be enough to constrain them. So there's always this combination of things. You want to reduce the opportunity to consequence, to barriers, to concrete steps the institution's taking, and then you want to, you know, change their inclination to do it in the first place, and that's about his or her personal change. And that's what we're most used to thinking about and talking about. But the other thing is that the practitioner themselves has to see that they need to be accountable for that victim, too. It's not just this batter has to be accountable, but I, as a practitioner, need to be accountable. I need to, when I go out on a call and it's a gone on arrival, I can't just do a sloppy little thing and say, oh, I'm going to recode this as a disturbance so it doesn't come off as a domestic and I don't have to write a report. Now, that would be a very common practice in policing around the country, is recoding domestic calls to disturbances so that it disappears, especially if you haven't done anything on the call, which is typically what happens on gone on arrivals or domestics that the officer doesn't really want to make an arrest for one reason or another. And so the first question is that practitioner being accountable to the victim? And when they do that, when they slough it off, when they do this, when they do that, they're not being accountable to the victims. When prosecutors make plea agreements with a defense attorney without even knowing the history of this offender, you know, is he a stalker, big-time batterer, is he a one-time pusher? If he shoved her and pushed her, this plea agreement might fit. But if he's a stalker, this plea agreement is a big compromise of her safety. So if a prosecutor is making deals with the defense attorney without knowing that, without doing the PSI, without looking into the history, without understanding the context in which this incident occurred, then he or she, one would have to say, is not really being accountable back to victim safety. So the accountability is not just the offender to the victim, but it's the practitioner. Every practitioner who touches that case, there's a handful of ways that they can be accountable to that victim. And by being accountable, it means that they have to act in a way that most uses their institutional power, most positions others in the institution to use their power to protect her. And so that's the second line of accountability. So when you think of accountability, think of it batterer to victim, then think practitioner to victim. Mm-hmm. And then another big one is the system needs to hold on to the due process rights of the offender. I mean, we can kind of get nasty on domestic violence and this is a terrible crime and we have to get tough with these guys or whatever. But in the end, our system of governance doesn't work if we don't have very, very strong safeguards in there against the abuse of power by the state of an individual. And so so there's all sorts of due process rights that our system has built into it so that, you know, you don't get every guy. You don't catch them all because you have to have a strong case. You have to have a provable case. You have to have beyond a reasonable doubt to say that we're going to take this person off the street or take away their freedom. And if you don't have that, you won't get to do it. And so this very high standard that we have in this country to convict people is not necessarily used across the board. I mean, that standard really works when people have money, they have money for good attorneys, et cetera. So you want a system that holds itself and others to that highest standard of the defendant's due process. Because that's the strongest system you can have. And a strong system like that is strong in other ways. But if you're weak in that area, you're going to be weak in other ways. And the other thing you're going to do is you're going to start picking up people you didn't really mean to pick up. You know, you don't just get batterers, but you end up getting the cousin and the uncle and this and that and bringing everybody into this big McDonaldized system. And, you know, you really want a system that's careful about people's due process, and that's the third line of accountability. The fourth line of accountability is to be accountable to other interveners in the system. So So lots of times, you know, you can hear a lot of officers squawking about all these prosecutors. They just plea bargain everything down to nothing, and, you know, you go out there and you get the bad guy, and then they let him go, and blah, 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 blah. And then you read the police report, and you think, when a prosecutor gets a police report and they're going to charge a case, they're looking at this and they're saying, can I make someone believe that I can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this guy did this? And you read some of these police reports and you think, you couldn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that anyone was home that night. I mean, they're just really incomplete reports there. You don't really understand where they got their probable cause. Both people used some kind of violence. Who was acting in self-defense? Who wasn't? You can't tell. And so the other thing is that a practitioner has to be accountable to other practitioners. There's nothing worse for a probation officer than a prosecutor they can't count on. I'm saying to this guy, you go to those groups, you don't go, you're going to jail. But many probation officers are dependent on the prosecutor saying, yeah, I'll take that case and I'll go forward and prosecute him for violation of probation. Or prosecutors who make a plea agreement before a pre-sentence investigation is done and then hand it over to the probation officer and say, I got this plea agreement. And the probation officer is looking at this thinking, this guy is a maniac. This is like no kind of a plea agreement. And in the process of doing that, the prosecutor has not allowed the probation officer to really do their job and do it well. So the third level of accountability is, are the practitioners being accountable to each other? Dispatcher to police to prosecution to probation to the judge. All the way down the line, are people positioning other people in the system in the best way to think of safety? And this is, Pat, where you come in at that safety center, is that one of the when people do the justice centers, they have to think about not just accountability to victims, but accountability to each other in that building. If I do my job this way, I need you to do your job this way, or what I did won't work.
Yeah.
And kind of holding each other to some agreements is really important.
Ellen, there was somebody on the line who had a safety audit done a number of years ago.
Uh-huh.
Is that person still on?
Is that Grand Forks or Seattle? Both did them.
Did they find that it truly made a difference in the way they related to each other, meaning interagency?
Oh, let's ask Grand Forks. Are you still on?
Yes, we're on.
When you did your audit, which was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, huh?
Yeah, so we finished in 2001.
Yeah. Did it build some relationships of accountability to each other any differently?
It definitely helped in some areas, and it, like with all the law enforcement and the Abuse and Rape Crisis Program, the courts and the state's attorney, there's some others that are kind of peripheral, like the jail and the parole and probation, but I think it at least opened up the door so we can go in there and talk to them and try to bring them on board again.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, if I was to add to that, Ellen, I think that it more or less opened the door for us in a lot of areas that we probably wouldn't have got in before.
Mm-hmm. And what about Seattle? There was some politics in your audit, I think, weren't there?
Yes, and unfortunately, neither one of us that is here today on this call was involved in that process.
No, it's probably fortunate that you weren't.
Probably.
I wasn't either, but I heard it wasn't nice.
Yes, there's been quite, I think, some fallout from it. But in the end, you know, the audit was in 2003. 4 years later, there have been developed some really good working relationships between police, prosecution, court, and probation.
Mm-hmm.
So even though there were challenges and issues with the audit and the report findings, I think there's been some resolution to those, and folks have been able to move forward and are open to pursuing future safety audits and looking at better coordination across agencies.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of brings, I don't know what the situation was there, but there's been a couple of audits that we've worked on where we get kind of halfway into it and we realize the whole reason someone got into this audit was because they wanted to expose a certain thing going on in some agency. Those are like the wrong reasons to do an audit or to use an audit. You know, I've been places where like the sheriff's department is just totally uncooperative with everyone. Well, then they want to do an audit in order to push the sheriff's office into changing or whatever. Those audits don't usually work if they're kind of predetermined that they're going to kind of point the finger at someone, even if someone is failing. It's not a, like a lethality review points the finger where it belongs. Whatever happened, happened, and they're going back and they're looking at it and they don't mince words about it. An audit, you're trying to prevent, you're trying to give people a planning tool to rethink the way that they're currently intervening, because they can see by doing this process that right here, if we keep doing it this way, someone's going to get hurt, and maybe even we can see where someone did, and so we're trying to close up that gap. In fact, at one time we were going to call the audit the CTG, closing the gap, but people couldn't say it three times real fast, so we had time to call it that. But that is what you're trying to do, is kind of find that little hole or that little crease in the system and fill it. So in one of the big places that is when practitioners don't think about what the next person down the line needs. You think, okay, I'm a cop, I'm out there, I got to have probable cause, I've got my probable cause, I recorded it, I documented it, I'm done. I got my paperwork in. Well, then the prosecutor gets it, and yes, it's nice to have their probable cause decision, but they've got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt this happened. So if the intervening officer had done three or four more things, it would have positioned the prosecutor better. And the same with the prosecutor. If they had, you know, they're saying, look, this is an event, I'm prosecuting an event. But if they would look at the, if they would not just say, I'm here to get prosecutions when I can, and when I can't, I can't. But sometimes you can get a prosecution you don't really want. It makes the situation worse, not better, especially when you have victims of violence who hit them back right in front of the cop. A prosecution of that actually can weaken that intervention with the abuser in that case, because now the abuser's got, you know, exactly what he wants. You know, now you're the one who's on probation. You're the one who's going to get in trouble. You're the one, if I drop a dime on you, you're going to jail. So you've actually positioned the victim in a worse place than before the intervention occurred. So, you know, so everyone's got to be thinking about who, you know, not just being accountable back to a particular task, but being accountable to each other in the ultimate task of reducing repeat violence, and whenever possible, trying to change the inclination of the abuser to abuse.
And that is really, really hard to do.
Oh,
to
yeah.
Get people to not be responsible for what their job description says they should do, but to also
go beyond that. You see, that's a little bit of the problem with our fragmented system, is that everyone's got a job to do. You know, I went out one day with a guy that was so good at his job, I couldn't believe it. I just thought, this guy should get a medal. And he was a deputy that served protection orders and warrants. And he could find any worm under any rock in our county. He just was just unbelievable. And the pace that this guy worked at, and he was way overweight, too. I mean, I'm overweight, too, and I couldn't keep up with this guy. He was jumping in and out of his car, doing this, doing that, and all this kind of stuff. And he just, from the minute he got in there, he was, let's go, let's get out of here. And I asked people, is this because I'm traveling around with him today that he's like this? And they said, nope, he's always like that. And so he was very, very good at his job. And one day we gave five different guys protection orders. You know, served them with them and told them to come to court the following Friday. And as we did it to these five different guys, I was saying to them, I said, damn, look, you know, that first guy, it's a nutcase. You know, I don't trust him one bit what he's going to do tonight. And do you think he's going to go over there? He said, I don't know. He says, but he got served, didn't he? And then I said, well, that third guy, though, I don't know about him. I didn't get much of a vibe off him that he was too dangerous. So I'm trying to talk to him about, which of these five guys do you think is dangerous? And he said, yeah, they're all dangerous if you ask me. But why would a woman get a protection order against her if it wasn't dangerous? So, yeah, they're all dangerous, that's it.
And then he said to me, I just got this really bad feeling that you're trying to come up with some idea that I should do something like ask him a question. I'm here to serve warrants, serve protection orders. I'm a mailman. Don't be going back to that little committee of yours and convincing them that I should be something else. But at the same time, I could see that he's the only person in the system that sees what the guy did when he got those papers. And whenever we have a killing in our neck of the woods, it's almost always when a woman's leaving him. She's just filed for divorce. She's gotten a protection order. She's done this. She's done that. The divorce is final. Something like that that makes him say, okay, it's over. She's dumping me. It's done. And that's when they'll go that to that extreme that you can't predict very easy. So for me, the person who watches him get those papers, it is a valuable input for her when she's thinking about her safety. And he just did not want me to suggest back at the committee that we should maybe have them ask a few questions. What are you going to do tonight? Where are you going to go? And then contact her and say, this is what happened when I served him, which is what, you know, I wanted to come back and recommend, and he was just dead set against it. So we have this notion in the criminal justice system of people operating in silos. I'm the cop, I'm the prosecutor, I'm the dispatcher, I'm the process server. In a CCR, a coordinated community response, or a justice center type of response, you're trying to break those silos down and saying, yes, I perform this function, but I do it as part of a bigger thing. And I'm accountable for the bigger thing, not my function only. That's a huge paradigm shift for a lot of people in the system because they're used to saying, look, we did our job. And when someone gets killed, this happens every time someone gets killed in a community, that you pick up the paper, you see that this guy shot this woman 5 times in the back and did this and did that. And the first thing you do is, you know, if you're a BIP program, did we have him in our group, and did he come, and if he didn't come, did we do something, and everyone's looking to see, did we do what we were supposed to do? Well, obviously, it's not about which one of us didn't do what we were supposed to do, but something didn't work for her safety. So the consciousness and the idea of moving towards a collective notion of accountability is still pretty thin in the kind of work we do because of the fragmented nature of our organizations. And that's why the justice centers could be a major influencer in defragmentizing that, but only if the purpose of getting together is not for one-stop shopping for the victims, but it's for the system to break out of that kind of insular, silo-type thinking and saying collectively we're responsible for victim safety, not individually. Does that make sense?
It does, but you know, not to monopolize, and I think I am monopolizing this conversation, but unless when you do a safety audit and when you get people collectively working together, whether it's on the committee or whether it's in a family justice center or whatever, if you're trying to persuade people on mid-level or frontline or first responder, not the chief, not the, you know, DA, you're trying to get those people to actually work the cases and work the system to be accountable to another agency without, you can't really do that, can you, Ellen, without the approval of their ultimate boss?
Yeah, I think you're right that you know, you're going to be as good as your leadership is.
Yeah.
If you've got a major player that's out of the picture, it's not going to work well. But if you get little loops of players, if you get dispatch and police working better together, that's good. If you get police and prosecutors, that's huge. If you get them on the same page, then they really can push very different cases in front of the courts. Now, that can be undermined a lot by a bench that won't back up any kind of a real criminal justice response. But on the other hand, if you can just get, you're never going to get every single agency all the way across the board to be totally enthusiastic about these, but if you get enough of the right ones in the key places to work together, then you're going to make a huge impact, and you kind of shame, in a funny way, the other ones into doing something better. So,
okay.
So what I in case you didn't notice, what I did was I talked about the five levels of accountability. Holding offenders accountable to victims, holding practitioners accountable to victims, holding practitioners accountable to due process of offenders, holding practitioners accountable to each other, and then agencies accountable to each other. So that, just like I think you're saying, Pat, it doesn't work for dispatch and police to kind of do all this kind of stuff if prosecution's going to drop the ball. So you need those agency leaders to say, okay, if you guys go this way, we'll go this way. And they need to set up a cooperative kind of working relationship together so that they're influencing each other's work and they're asking each other, what do you need? Like, you know, like, for example, I did an audit in one city, and the police just asked all the time, has anybody been drinking? Who's been drinking? How much have you had to drink? And then I asked the prosecutors, what do you do with that? I mean, all you got all these cops out there asking people how much have they had to drink and are they drinking? What do you do with it? And the prosecutors said, well, it's not really very usable information. I said, but they're asking all the time, every time. And it's in the police reports. What should be in the police reports? And then the prosecutor said, I need to know, am I getting a credible statement? So it's not has he been drinking, but is he giving a coherent statement to the officer at the time? Whether he remembers it or not later isn't so important to me as when the officer was asking him questions, could they track with him? Could they give a credible statement? And if the officer thought that was, that's what I need to have in the report. Well, that's the kind of a thing that when you talk about agency-to-agency cooperation, you want the people sitting down and saying, what do I need from these other agencies? And then getting it that way. That's what a CCR is all about. A coordinated community response is all about agencies figuring out what they need from each other to act on this case in a way that protects victims. So an audit really is a method of doing a CCR. So this last one is this whole thing of agencies being held accountable to each other.
Ellen, this is Casey. You have about 15 minutes.
Yeah. I was just looking at that thing. I seem to react away here again. But anyways, I think accountability is such a huge thing because when you're doing your audit, you're just constantly looking in those five levels. The other thing is that I always like to do numbers. There's 8 audit trails, there's 12 features of institutions that don't work, there's 5 levels of accountability, there's 5 different types of domestic violence. And now I'm going to say there's 4 aspects to victim safety. And so victim safety is not just figuring out, will this guy beat this woman up again? You know, is he a stalker or a slapper? That's very important to know. What is this individual capable of? What's he willing to do? When's he willing to do it? In cases of where you have the women as, sometimes you'll have women as batterers. It'll be rare in heterosexual relationships, but not so rare in gay and lesbian relationships that will be same-sex battering. But basically in battering cases where you've got one person using a patterned use of intimidation, coercion, and violence to control the other, typically that's going to be a male doing that with a female. And when you're looking at that, you're asking the question, this guy named Fernando Medeiros, he used to do batters groups all the time. Now he does a lot of work with child protection and a lot of different things about men of color who batter and helpful ways of helping them change. And Fernando talks about that every person, every one of us on the phone here, we have a menu of behaviors that we're willing to use in personal relationships. And not all those behaviors are loving, kind, intimate, sharing and caring teddy bear kind of behaviors. Probably, if we were all in the room, I'd have you show hands. But if I were to ask you, how many of you have ever walked out of a room mad at your partner and slammed the door or kicked something on the way out or tossed something down or showed some kind of aggressive move on your way out of a room? And if I was in an audience of like 75 people, 50 of them raised their hand, men and women. How many of you have lied to your partner? Now, people will lie and not raise their hand, but half of them will raise their hand and say they've lied. How many of you tried to make your partner feel bad? You were hurt by something he or she did, you whatever, and you wanted them to feel bad, so you said or did something that intentionally make them feel bad. Most people, a lot of people raise their hands and other people just kind of sneak up a finger. And I always ask, how many of you have ever given your partner the silent treatment? Lots of people raise their hands. Then the big question is, how many of you do you have partners who wished and prayed that you would give them the silent treatment? And lots of people raise their hands. So we have, all of us on the phone and in these trainings that we do, we have this menu of behaviors of things we're willing to do that aren't very nice to our partners when we're mad or hurt or upset or jealous or whatever. For some of us, in that menu, included in that, the kinds of things that you will and can do, is a patterned use of intimidation, coercion, and violence. In other words, we're willing to intentionally place our partners in fear of us, sexually or physically, and then play on that to get what we want in the relationship. And that distinguishes batterers from non-batterers. In other words, a non-batterer might do some of these behaviors, but they're not going to engage in a particular pattern and a strategy to place that person in fear in order to be able to control that person. So fear-based relationships typically have someone who's producing that fear. Now, there can be a case where a woman's been really severely battered in a past relationship. She comes in to a relationship with a non-batterer, and she's still afraid of him. Obviously, that happens. That can happen. But most of the cases you have is that fear is actually being planted, fed, produced by the abuser. And so a person who is willing, able, and prone to producing fear in their partner in order to control them is a batterer. And then we tend to look and say, well, how far will they go? And that's how much risk she's in. So I want you to look at the handout that we sent you and to say that, yes, that's true, that who he is and what he's willing to do is a major determinant about how much risk she faces. But also her circumstances that she's in, her immigration status, so whether or not she speaks fluent English, if she has a mental illness, her age, her sexual identity, all these personal circumstances of her makes her more vulnerable or less vulnerable to a batterer. The same thing with aspects of her culture. Women come into a battering relationship in a particular body with a particular background, with a particular cultural affiliation, a particular nationality, a particular religion, particular faith beliefs. And those things act on a continuum. So in many ways, our culture is a strength for us, and it for all of us, regardless of which culture we come from, that almost all cultures have elements in it that are anti-wife beating. And many, many cultures have, the same cultures have elements in it that promote it. So where on the continuum is her family? Is her family surrounding him and supporting him? Or is her family ostracizing him and supporting her? Which of those two things is happening? And it doesn't have to be those two. It can be as a family somehow surrounding him with confrontation, not ostracizing him at all. So aspects of culture, aspects of the personal thing that the batter did, aspects of the individual circumstances are all things that lead to whether or not certain interventions were safe. And the final thing is the institutional response itself can pose danger to people. Getting arrested if you're a recent immigrant can be a major problem. So when you're trying to do an audit, you oftentimes try to think, okay, what should our policy be? What should our this be? And you're trying to standardize how people act. Let's get everybody to do this. Let's get everybody to do this. The problem with that is when everybody does this, no matter who they're doing it to, they're doing something different because this arresting this person will have a very different impact than arresting this person. So when I worked in the Marine Corps, we promoted a coordinated community response. We promoted arresting all batterers. We didn't promote the command prosecuting them. Because prosecuting a Marine, was where I worked in the Marine Corps, was going to mean that Marine would lose his or her job. And losing his or her job was not going to make the victim safer. So, you know, we didn't promote convictions at all unless person kept violating, and the victim was clear that they needed to get away from them, etc. We promoted other kinds of sanctions that were not career enders. So when you have something like mandatory arrest having different impacts on different communities, you really have to think about not backing off of every stand and say we can't do anything because it'll impact some people negatively, because then that impacts a lot of people negatively. Instead, what you have to do is try to figure out who is going to be helped by this approach, who's going to be harmed, how do we help people, the people that we want to help, without harming the people that we don't want harmed. And that's where you get things like, I think people will talk to you later about things like the Crossroads program. It's a program to confront battered women who assault their batterers without convicting them and putting them on probation, et cetera, which makes them vulnerable to more violence. So one of the things that you have to do in an audit is you have to really look at these aspects of safety. Look for all of them. Don't just look for, is he likely to hit her again? Look for how she might be vulnerable because of language barriers. Look for how she might be vulnerable because of her own belief systems, what she's been taught and what she holds dear and near to her, her socialization. All these things are things that we have to take into consideration when we're building an institutional response to a group of people called battered women, who, in fact, is not a singular group of people, but really cross even gender boundaries, so that not all people being battered are women. Most are. Sometimes men are battered, and sometimes, many times, men are assaulted. So, and they're the victims of domestic violence, even though not the victims of battering. So, I was just, you know, the purpose of today's call is just to get you to not think too overly simplified about safety and about accountability, but to think in these little bit more complex ways. So it's 3:09. Can we just do a go around and see if anyone's still awake and anything that y'all might have to say? Judy? Are you there, Judy? Texas once, Texas twice. How about
transport? No, if you're talking to Texas, you're talking to Debbie.
Oh, well, there. See?
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
Judy's in Michigan, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, are you still there, Judy, in Michigan? Okay. How about Debbie, Texas? I shouldn't do this because it just... Grand Forks?
Oh, we're still with you.
And so we're ending now. Is there any last thing you have to say, or has this been helpful at all?
You know, I think it's been helpful for me just because I've been struggling with what does it mean for the agencies to be accountable to each other. So now I have a little bit clearer idea of that piece. And it's just good to go over these different aspects of everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and Amy?
Amy had to leave. This is Sharon from Seattle.
Uh-huh.
I'm still here.
Okay.
And this is helpful, and especially in light of some planning that we're doing, considering a family justice center.
Okay. New Orleans?
I thought, you know, it was helpful personally. The idea of actually conducting one seems incredibly intimidating, but, you know, I think that it can really be valuable. I think that we need it. It's just a matter of getting people to get on board with us and open up to us.
Yeah.
And I would echo that it seems incredibly challenging, but the last point you had, Ellen, about considering all aspects of an action taken by any one agency. That is particularly challenging when I think that through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the police really thinking through the ramifications of an arrest, or the DA thinking through the ramifications of prosecution versus not accepting or refusing a case. The prospect of all that just seems it seems so difficult for me to comprehend. Not because, like I work in civil protective orders, I consider ramifications and talk to petitioners about the ramifications of that. But boy, that is difficult when someone has approached your public agency to do X, which is what you do. That's what X is, your product. And it's difficult when you try and consider and get the person who's approached you to consider those same ramifications. But yes, it's been helpful. It's always helpful.
Okay. Anyone else have anything you want to say or questions before we leave? This is Debbie in Texas. I sort of got cut off.
Oh.
I just wanted to tell you that we're in here taking notes, and again, we've got some more ideas, and we seem to keep getting new ideas every time we listen to you.
Okay.
So we really appreciate it.
Well, maybe you should never do anything, just sit and listen for about 5 or 6 years and then write a report on.
Well, at least the report, well, we're not even thinking about that just yet. We just want to get to it, the audit first.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you.
Okay. So remember, anyone, if you do, call Casey if you want more of an individual thing beamed into a meeting that you pulled together in your community. I don't know if I'm supposed to be offering this, Casey, but...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. And so thanks, everybody, for joining us today. Thanks, Ellen.
Okay.
And a reminder to folks to fax us your evaluation forms or email them to us. It really helps. And please join us on Thursday at the same time when Trish Irwin's going to talk about how to think and act like an auditor. So have a good Wednesday.
She'll be good. She just did an audit in San Francisco, and she's got a lot of fresh ideas and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. Thanks,
Thank you very much.